From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with the man who ran the CIA's covert operation in Afghanistan during the Soviet invasion, Milt Bearden. We'll discuss what's become known as blowback. Bearden spent 30 years in the CIA and has written a spy novel based on his experiences in Afghanistan. Also, journalist and novelist Carl Hiaasen on mining South Florida for the material in his columns and his mysteries. Hiaasen is a second-generation Floridian. He's written his ninth novel. And part one of rock historian Ed Ward's review of Nuggets 2, a compilation of psychedelic obscurities from England and beyond. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. New charges have been filed against Richard Reed, the man accused of trying to blow up a flight between Paris and Miami last month. NPR's Tovia Smith reports.
Officials say the explosives in Reed's shoes would have been powerful enough to take down the American Airlines aircraft if alert crew members and passengers had not foiled his plan. Reed was charged initially with interfering with a flight crew, but a grand jury in Boston has now returned 9 charges against him, including attempted murder and one new offense created after September 11th, attempted wrecking of a mass transportation vehicle. The indictment also alleges that Reed was trained by Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. U.S. Attorney General John Ashcroft says Americans must continue to be vigilant.
Reed's indictment alerts us to a clear, unmistakable threat that Al-Qaeda could attack the United States again.
Reed is facing up to 5 life sentences for the alleged crimes. Tovia Smith, NPR News, Boston.
Authorities in Sacramento, California say 3 former members of the Symbionese Liberation Army have been arrested in connection with a 1975 murder and bank robbery. A sheriff spokeswoman identified those arrested as Emily Harris, her former husband Bill Harris, and a third suspect, Mike Borton. She said the 3 will be charged with first-degree murder for shooting a woman customer during the robbery of the Crocker National Bank. The SLA was notorious for the kidnapping of newspaper heiress Patty Hearst, who later joined the group. Senator Ted Kennedy is proposing a freeze on roughly a quarter of the $1.3 trillion tax cut passed last year by Congress. The Massachusetts Democrat says the country can no longer afford such a large cut. NPR's David Wellner reports from the Capitol.
Speaking at the National Press Club here in Washington, Kennedy said that by putting on hold tax cuts for the wealthy that are due to kick in after 2004, the country would have $350 billion more dollars for needs such as education, health care, and domestic security.
These future tax cuts for those at the top are not part of the fight against the recession. They are not scheduled to occur until long after the economy emerges from the downturn.
Kennedy is the first prominent Democrat to call for scaling back the tax cut. He says his proposal won't raise anyone's taxes above current levels and allows $1 trillion worth of tax cuts to go forward. President Bush's press secretary, Ari Fleischer, says the president considers Kennedy's proposal a tax increase. David Wellner, NPR News, the Capitol.
In stocks today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 212 points to close at 97,012. In heavy trading of more than 1.4 billion shares, that's 9,712. The Nasdaq lost 56 points, or 3%, to close at 1,944. This is NPR News. The UN Security Council has adopted sanctions against Osama bin Laden and his associates. The resolution calls for all UN member nations to impose an arms embargo and a travel ban on anyone associated with bin Laden, his Al-Qaeda terrorist network, and the Taliban. A second short-track speed skater is alleging that last month's U.S. Olympic trials were fixed so that an African-American skater could make the Olympic team. NPR's Howard Berkus reports from Salt Lake City.
The second race-fixing allegation comes from Ron Biondo, who told the Cleveland Plain Dealer that Olympic medal favorite Apollo Ohno blocked him during the final Olympic qualifying race to help 2 friends make the team. Ohno had qualified earlier by winning every race he skated, but he finished back in the pack in the final. 1998 Olympian Tommy O'Hare has also charged that the race was fixed, costing him a return to the Games. The two skaters who allegedly benefited were Rusty Smith and Shani Davis, the first African-American to make the U.S. Olympic short track team. An attorney for the U.S. Speed Skating Association says the issue is moot because referees at the race did not detect nor call any illegal blocking. Still, the case is set to go before an independent arbitrator next week. Howard Berkus, NPR News, Salt Lake City.
The White House has disclosed another link between the Bush administration and Enron, the failed energy broker. Press Secretary Ari Fleischer said White House economic advisor Larry Lindsey studied the potential impact of the Enron collapse as it became apparent that the huge company was in trouble. Lindsey was on Enron's corporate board and received $50,000 from the company in 2000. He said he didn't discuss the company's financial problems with Enron officials. Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, providing customized approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America, on the web at SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. Milt Bearden's resume reads like a tour through the Cold War. He was a CIA operative in China at the end of the Cultural Revolution. He later ran interference with KGB counterparts as a station chief in Pakistan and Khartoum. And in the mid-80s, he directed the agency's covert aid program to Afghan rebels during the Soviet invasion. After 30 years in intelligence, Bearden retired and took up writing. His spy novel, Black Tulip, is based on his time in Afghanistan, delivering arms and military training to the Mujahideen. Bearden says that the war between the Mujahideen and the Soviets was at a stalemate until the U.S. equipped the Afghan rebels with Stinger anti-aircraft missiles. I asked him to describe the Stinger.
Well, it's a shoulder-fired anti-aircraft missile that the reality is it's super sophisticated, but it's what you would call a fire-and-forget weapon. All you have to do is follow some fairly simple instructions and do what you've been taught, which could last a few days or a week or not much more than that. And if an aircraft is within about 10,000 feet of you, you're likely to be able to bring him down, and that's a helicopter or a fast-moving fighter aircraft. And the description of the first Stinger shoot down in the Black Tulip is, you know, word for word, the way it happened. It's just exactly an account of the way this engineer and his team were out on a hunter-killer mission in Jalalabad, or outside Jalalabad, and brought down the first three helicopters in September 26, 1986, and turned the war around.
Now, part of your responsibilities, aside from funneling in weaponry to the tune of about over $1 billion into Afghanistan, was overseeing the covert aid program for Afghan rebels fighting the Soviets and to provide military training to them. What kind of military instruction did the CIA impart to the guerrillas?
Well, the CIA was only indirectly involved in most of the training. I think it's overdone. This is a very good area to get into on this whole thing. Training, certainly on the sophisticated weapon systems like the Stinger, was choreographed by the U.S., and that was carried out over the next 3 years of the war. The rest of the training was pretty much small arms and crew-served weapons. The question you raise is the blowback issue, and it's a good one, and I don't usually shy away from it. So here is my take on that. We had the Soviet Union invade Afghanistan on Christmas Eve in 1979, and we had a very good man, a moral man, as president at the time, Jimmy Carter, who said, you know, this cannot stand. So he made the decision to go in and do something about it, and he, rather than reacting with his Defense Department or just sending diplomatic notes of protest, decided to take the third alternative, which is to put CIA onto the thing. And the mission was always the same. It never changed. It was to stop the Soviets, turn them around, and make them leave Afghanistan. By the time I got there, about 50% of the Afghan population had been killed, wounded, or exiled into awful, squalid refugee status by the Soviets. So I think that what we did was proper, it was needed, and it was reasonably well executed. My problems start to arise where everybody else is due, and that's after the Soviets quit Afghanistan in 1989. Then what?
So you're saying that the CIA was not involved in training the Mujahideen in any terrorist tactics?
Correct. But let's take a look at this realistically. The terrorist business is often murky. My freedom fighter could be your terrorist. But we had a lot of rules going in our engagement in Afghanistan. They begin with little things like anti-personnel mines. The United States government, CIA, said, we're not going to do that. We're not going to buy any. We're not going to distribute any. We're not going to use any, because the truth about those mines is that they'll be blowing off the legs of young boys and girls tending goats for the next 50 years. They don't help you that much, so we won't do that. On terrorism, we did not train the Afghans to commit acts of terrorism. We obviously trained them to conduct military operations. But, for example, I spent considerable energy in my role as political agent in that part of the world, telling the Mujahideen that there were no percentages, no real advantages in doing things like car bombs or truck bombs. They have a lot of collateral damage. And so the truth is that there wasn't a lot of terrorism if you look at it objectively. The Soviet embassy in Kabul never got blown up. The Soviet embassy in Islamabad, just across the border into Pakistan, never got blown up. I don't think we can go back to a single act of Afghan terrorism during that entire war.
Let's talk about Osama bin Laden. When did he first appear on the agency radar as a major player in the anti-Soviet insurgents?
We knew he was there. He was one of a large number of Gulf Arabs that had shown up for this jihad. It was their jihad. It was, we wanted a piece of it because of, A, it was the right thing to do, and B, the Soviet Union was involved. But these fundraisers and they included not only bin Laden, but Saudi Red Crescent and all kinds of other groups, some of them very, very good and proper, and others, a little on the psychopathic side, contributed a lot of money to that effort. They built a lot of refugee camps and homes for orphans of the fallen Mujahideen and their widows as well. And in fact, all the way up till the withdrawal of the Soviets, bin Laden would have been thought of more of as a Robin Hood type character than any kind of a problem. We didn't have any contact with them, and for good reason, because none was needed. And so a lot of the speculation and stories that Osama bin Laden was our guy and that we recruited Arabs and trained them and all this for the jihad, that's just not true, regardless of who says it.
What do you think of the United States and the Britain's obsession with pursuing the manhunt of Osama bin Laden? Are we making the same mistake again, the danger of demonizing him as this towering personality, as the mastermind of the World Trade Center and Pentagon attacks, as the figure?
I think we are. The Brits and the Americans are in pretty much lockstep here, so we really don't have much daylight between us. But I think both of us as cultures like to put a face and a name on our adversaries, and we do personalize. I mean, look at the Gulf War. This was something to where, I mean, we all heard our president say, Saddam. How many times? Saddam Hussein, Saddam. We personalize these things. I think that can be, I guess, okay if it's a Saddam Hussein or a Hitler or something like that. But on something as as poorly understood as this international terrorist thing, I believe it could be even dangerous to think that, just by hauling Osama bin Laden onto the dock in a burlap bag and saying, this is it, there will be a sense that it's over after that.
What comes next for the CIA in this new war on terrorism? And you've described this new phase in the war as a Kipling's ageless game of treachery and betrayal. What does that game entail? And I suppose many people are questioning whether the CIA is up to it as it stands now.
We're still talking about Afghanistan as you know, that's the Kipling's ageless game of treachery and betrayal. And they brought a lot of people back in who had the experience over there, and sometimes it may have looked like Dad's Army or Granddad's Army of CIA guys working with U.S. Army Special Forces people in very small units. But when you look at what's happened over the last 100 days in Afghanistan, the inescapable conclusion is that the people who were doing this, who were managing this, understood it. Just when the Northern Alliance reached a point moving into Kabul that could have turned this thing upside down, they stopped. At the key point, all of a sudden, we heard a new term, Eastern Alliance. And you had special forces and CIA people in very small groups working with a lot of the old commanders in the East as they sought to move through Tora Bora and now through Paktia province. And the same thing was going on down in the south. None of this was an accident. This was, I think, a very well thought out game book, a playbook for how to do this thing without making all of the big mistakes that one makes.
I'm talking with Milt Bearden. He is a 30-year veteran of the CIA. He ran the CIA's covert aid program to Afghan rebels fighting the Soviets in the 80s. He served as a station chief in Pakistan and Khartoum for the agency. Bearden's the author also of a novel about the war in Afghanistan called Black Tulip. We're going to take a break now, Milt, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with CIA veteran Milt Bearden. He ran the agency's covert operations in Afghanistan during the Soviet-Afghan War. He's the author of a novel of war in Afghanistan called Black Tulip. If we could pull back right now and take a global look at global terrorism, during your tenure in the CIA, the Cold War was the rationale for everything. It was the backdrop for almost every move you made there, for better or for worse. Can you contrast that with the situation now, what it means for Central Intelligence not to have an overriding ideology or historical context on which to base its operations in this fight against loosely based, loosely affiliated global terrorism networks?
I mean, you've really got it. I mean, that's, that's tough. I mean, I joined the CIA in 1964 after the organization was 15, 16, 17 years old. But the agency was formed by the National Security Act of 1947, and that alone tells you what it was all about. I mean, it tells you that basically this is a thing that was pulled together by Harry Truman because the Soviet thing bothered him a lot. And everything that was done by the CIA up until Boxing Day in 1991, when the Soviet Union disappeared, had some tentacle reaching in to make it part of that great big picture of the Soviet Union, whether it was Afghanistan or Central America or the gamesmanship in Africa. You're right. You've got it exactly right, centered around this perfect enemy that had made a world that was very, very orderly when you think about it. You had two powers. Now, the Soviets were perhaps overestimated, but you had a bipolar world, most of the countries of the world lined up around one of those two poles, and there was no such thing as a failed state. That came after the Soviet Union disappeared from the scene, and we became the sole remaining superpower. And if you're, and so then some states became like, you know, why bother to throw any money? The Soviets aren't going to pick these guys up, so leave them to their own devices. And we end up with the Afghanistans, the Somalias, and a few other countries.
I'm talking with CIA veteran Milt Bearden. He ran the agency's covert operations in Afghanistan during the Soviet-Afghan War. He's written a spy novel of war in Afghanistan. It's called Black Tulip. Now, what was your first assignment or skill that you had to develop where you said, oh, yeah, this is the cloak and dagger stuff I came here for?
Well, the first thing they do to you is you take off and go disappear somewhere that I don't think I'm still allowed to say, but you go through the school, the training, and you just learn all, you know, I mean, in 1964 terms, it would probably be something that every kid has nowadays, but, you know, I mean, you'd learn everything from locks and picks, how wonderful that is. I mean, you open things that people don't want you to open, and flaps and seals, which is, you know, getting into mail and then doing all kinds of covert communications. But this is still at a time when CIA didn't have the computing power of the laptop computer that's probably, you know, on the desk in front of you right now. But we were learning the trade. We were absolutely convinced of who we as a nation were. Don't forget, it was only starting in 64. You know, the Tonkin Gulf resolution, and America was still feeling pretty good. The Kennedy thing had shaken us, but it had not rattled us. That would all come later. And so this was a wonderful time. I spent only a year doing the training thing, and then I was in Germany as a young CIA officer because I had German as well as Chinese. And I was over there more or less as watching secondarily what the Chinese were up to in Europe. So I had Chinese and German kept me in German-speaking Europe for years and years.
Did you ever in your 30 years in the CIA have to pick a lock?
You know, I didn't. In my 30 years, no, but in my 30 years, when I had to have a lock picked, there was always a guy that did that so much better than the guy that taught me how to do it. And in the interim period, after let's say the mid 70s, we didn't you know, in the Frank Church period and all that, those things were no longer thought of as cool, and so they didn't teach them anymore, except to people who would really, that would be what they would do, kind of second story guys.
Well, just to show how naive I am, I have to ask you this question, which is in the book, Black Tulip, you present an interesting mind game that the spy Alexander plays with the Soviet commanders and operatives in Afghanistan, and he leaves a note for them in the setup for an operation to blow up a Soviet ammunition facility. And the note is designed to put the Soviets on edge, I suppose. Nothing's spelled out plainly. He signs the note, has someone sign the note with the name of one of the 99 names of Allah. And it's interpreted as a game by the Soviets, a very sophisticated one. He also sends a black tulip, the symbol of death, to the Soviets in Afghanistan. Does that kind of stuff really go on?
Oh, I did all of that stuff, yeah. I mean, but that's because I'm a hopeless romantic, and I think maybe not everybody does that way, but so much of the stuff in the Black Tulip is right out of the way. I did that war for 3 years. During the Afghan War, it developed that there were supposed to be toy bombs being put out there by the Soviets. These were ballyhooed all over the American media and on broadcast television as just another sign of how evil the Soviets were to create bombs in the shape of toys so that little children would have their arms and legs blown off by them. Truth was, it wasn't true. There were some small mines that they were dropping from helicopters that looked like something a kid would pick up, and then in fact they did, and they got hurt. But the story drove the Soviets so nuts that I was asked often by Washington, what do I think about it? I said, the story isn't true, but don't let that stop you from exploiting it. And so we really played them hard on that one. And I even sent to the KGB chief catalogs from Toys R Us. And I like to go through my life saying that that turned it over for him. He finally just ran screaming out to the airport and said, get me out of here. I give you that one free because a couple of the others I can't give you. But one of the things that haunts me to this day is this story that is still out there. And when I was in Moscow last time, some of the former Soviet troopers kind of got word to me that they still held a grudge on this event. I told you earlier that I had discouraged the use of car bombs and truck bombs because this would lose sympathy for the Mujahideen. And very proudly, one time, I was advised that, Mr. Milt, we have just done a very successful camel bomb operation. And they had taken a camel, loaded it with a bunch of explosives, and put it by a Soviet garrison in Jalalabad, where everybody knows where that is today, and detonated it, and it had taken out a lot of troops. And I had never told them to do a camel bomb, but they thought that since I didn't say don't do a camel bomb, that that would be okay. And this one still comes back at me. I mean, it's almost a bizarre, weird story of how these people say, well, we can't do car bombs and truck bombs because Mr. Milt says that's bad, but let's do a camel bomb and somehow that's going to be okay. So that one is still out there.
Milt Bearden, I want to thank you very much for talking with us today on Fresh Air.
Been terrific being with you.
Milt Bearden served as an intelligence officer in the CIA for 30 years. His spy novel, The Black Tulip, is out in paperback. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. By the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, South Florida as fodder for crime novels and biting satire. We talk with Carl Hiaasen. He has a new novel. Also, part one of rock historian Ed Ward's review of Nuggets 2, a compilation of psychedelic obscurities from England and beyond. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Ethan Hawke, the actor, writes novels. Billy Bob Thornton has a new album out, so why shouldn't Carl Hiaasen, the best-selling Florida-based crime novelist, write a rock song? That song, which Hiaasen wrote and recorded with Warren Zevon, is featured in his new novel, Basket Case. In the novel, it's performed by rock star Jimmy Stoma. But Stoma's found dead, and obituary writer Jack Tagger becomes suspicious. Hiaasen came to fiction writing after a career in journalism. He still writes a twice-weekly column for the Miami Herald. A new collection of his columns has just been published called Paradise Screwed. Terry began her interview with Carl Hiaasen with a reading from the opening of his new novel, Basket Case.
Regarding the death of James Bradley Stomarty, what first catches my attention is his age. 39, that's 7 years younger than I am. I'm drawn to the young and old, but who isn't? The most avidly read obituaries are of those who died too soon and those who lasted beyond expectations. What everybody wants to know is, why them? What was their secret or their fatal mistake? Could the same happen to me? I like to know myself. Something else about James Bradley Stomarty, the name. I'm sure I've heard it before, but there's no clue in the facts from the funeral home. Private service is Tuesday, ashes to be scattered in the Atlantic. In lieu of flowers, the family requests donations be made to the Cousteau Society. That's classy. I scan the list of survived bys and note a wife, sister, uncle, mother. No kids, which is somewhat unusual for a 39-year-old straight guy, which I assume, from his marital status, James Bradley Stomarty to be. Tapping a key on my desktop, I am instantly wired into our morgue, although I'm the only one in the newsroom who still calls it that. Resource Retrieval Center is what the memos say, but morgue is more fitting. It's here they keep all dead stories dating back to 1975, which in a newspaper's memory is about as fresh as dinosaur dung. I type in the name of the deceased. Bingo. I'm careful not to chuckle or even smile, as I don't wish to alert my ever-watchful editor. Our newspaper publishes only one feature obituary each day. Other deaths are capsulized in brief paragraphs or ignored altogether. For years, the paper ran two daily full-length obits, but recently the death page lost space to the weather page, which had lost space to the celebrity eye page, which had lost space to horoscopes. The shrunken news hole leaves room for only a single story, so I am now cagey about committing to a subject. My editor is not the flexible sort. Once I tell her whom I'm writing about, there's no turning back, even if someone far more interesting expires later in the news cycle.
That's Carl Hiaasen reading from the opening of his new novel, Basket Case. So who is the person who has just died?
The person who has just died is a faded rock and roll star from the 80s who's known as Jimmy Stoma, who was the front man for an outrageous 80s band called Jimmy and the Slut Puppies.
Why did you want the mystery to revolve around the dead leader of a rock band?
If you work in a newsroom and you did this for a living, writing obituaries, you would it's the sort of story you would gravitate to because it has an instant sort of younger audience. It has some resonance with your own, you know, taste in music. And it's sort of a grab-me story. It's sort of you know right away it's going to be a good headline, so you want to do the story. And I just thought, for an obituary writer who, as the narrator in my book, is sort of trying to write his way out of a bad job and looking for a big story to hang his star on, this is a good one. He sees this as his ticket back to respectability.
And of course, you had to write some lyrics for the book, and you actually even with Warren Zevon wrote a whole song, Basket Case. Which is the hit single that the band had. It's also the title of your book. Before we actually hear some of this song, tell us why you felt you needed to actually make a record to be a companion with the book.
I don't know. It wasn't really something I felt I needed. It sounded like it was going to be fun at the time. The book was done, and the title of the book was all set. And I realized that there are lyrics sprinkled throughout the novel that I sort of had to write to fit the story and to fit certain songs that play a role in sorting out the mystery. And I only had two lines of lyrics for the song Basket Case. And Warren is a friend of mine, a great songwriter. And I said just on a kind of hoot, I said, would you mind, you know, wouldn't it be fun to help me finish this song? And we'd have a real song to go with the book. And he very graciously and some have some masochistic sense of friendship agreed to do it. And he and I worked out the lyrics, sort of faxing various lines back and forth, and we got those hammered out. He just did the music and sent me a CD one day and it had this great guitar lick in it, and it was really amazing. I called him back. I said, "This is way too good for Jimmy and the Slud Puppies. What are we going to do now?"
Well, I guess right now it's time to hear the record. So this is Basket Case with a lyric by Carl Hyacin and Warren Zevon, music by Warren Zevon, performed by Warren Zevon.
My baby is a basket case, a bipolar mama in leather and lace, face like an angel, she's a perfect waste. My baby is a basket case. Dragon's daughter, Calamity Jane, smoke on the water, water on the brain. She's pretty as a picture and totally crazed. My baby is a basket case.
Newspaper columnist and mystery writer Carl Hyacin is my guest. His new novel, Basket Case, isn't about an obituary writer who finds a mystery in the obituary that he's writing for a dead musician. How come you're still writing columns in spite of the fact that you're a very successful novelist?
Because I'm not a well person. I should have bailed a long time ago. Because I love the business. I believe in the business. It's a pure business. If you do it right and you do it with your heart, I mean, it does get in your veins. It's a cliche, but it's true. I grew up in it, sort of in the newsroom. I mean, I've been in the business a long time. I think there's nothing more noble than going out and writing an important story that can help someone who has no other voice speaking for him or her, and you can actually change lives in a positive way. It's a good business to be in, and it's hard to shake free of it. The other side of that, Terry, is also that there's no doubt that working in a place like South Florida, which is as weird as it gets, I certainly can mine the real life news stories and the real life characters and for the novels. I mean, one feeds the other, and there's just, you can't spend a couple days down there and not see how fertile the territory is for a novelist as well as for a journalist. So I'm certainly, the two sides of that, my life complement each other in that way.
Yeah, you write about South Florida in your columns and in your novels. South Florida was surprisingly one of the centers of terrorist activity. I mean, several of the terrorists who were involved in the hijacking lived in South Florida for a while. I think they went to a flight school there. Is that right?
Yeah, there were 14 of the 19, amazingly, lived and had some training in South Florida. And
which
and
is kind of amazing. Like, when you ask yourself, where would anti-Semitic hijackers most like to live? How about South Florida, where there's lots of Jewish retirees living?
Right. I mean, not far from where the butterfly ballots were falling for Pat Buchanan, improbably enough. I mean, there's so many. It seems like so many major news stories have some sort of South Florida connection. And I was amazed. I thought nothing would surprise me anymore. But when, after the tragedy here, and they started running the photos, the mugshots of these characters and where they lived and the addresses on their driver's licenses were all coming back to places in Florida. I thought, oh, my God, how could this possibly be? And, and I thought about it, and I even wrote about it, to the extent that I think it is a place where outlaws have always felt comfortable. They've always accepted. They always blend in. These are guys that are walking around paying for everything with cash, practically. South Florida opens its arms to anybody with cash in their pockets, and as we've exhibited with the drug trade over the years, it's a place where you can buy respectability, you can buy privacy, because it's a very transient place. Not many people who are born there hang around. I mean, it's just a place populated by people from other places, and they don't know their neighbors that well, and it was an easy place for these guys to get lost, and they had no problem whatsoever operating there and drew no suspicion to themselves.
Well, other things that have happened connected with terrorism in South Florida, the first anthrax letter was discovered at the office of the Globe in South Florida. Now, that may very well have been a domestic terrorist, but still terrorism. The flight from France on which the guy had explosives in his shoe was bound from Miami.
The Get Smart guy. Yeah, really. What reruns was he watching?
Has this gotten to a lot of people in South Florida? Are people starting to feel
we write
like,
about it. Yeah. Certainly, it's like how much of it you can take. You know, we've got, this is an example. you just feel like there's a compass of weirdness, and no matter how many times it spins, that the arrow is going to point our way inevitably. And I use an example. After O.J. Simpson, the second trial in which the civil jury, found him culpable in the deaths of his wife and Ron Goldman, and he announced he'd be leaving L.A., you know, I remember saying to my wife, I said, you know what? That guy is moving to Miami. I'll bet you anything. And sure enough, there he is, and he's already drawing the attention of law enforcement authorities. Now, it just seems it's inevitable migration our way, but it's always been that way. Going back, I mean, in the Civil War, you had people running to South Florida hide. The old Wild West, a lot of the great outlaws of the Wild West spent time in Florida hiding out in the swamps. I think to some extent most of the swamps are gone, but for whatever reason, the attraction of the place is still there.
Carl Hiaasen's new novel is Basket Case. He writes a column for the Miami Herald. We'll hear more of his conversation with Terry Gross after the break. This is Fresh Air. We're back with novelist and Miami Herald columnist Carl Hiaasen. His new novel is Basket Case.
Now, how did your family get to South Florida?
Well, my grandfather was originally from Norway, and his family migrated to North Dakota, and he got a law degree. And as soon as he had a job offer to get out of the North Dakota winters, he wasted no time hopping a train. And so he settled down there in 1922, which is considered ancient times. And my father was born down there, and I was, and my son, but that's not the common story. Most people are much newer arrivals than that.
Describe what it looked like then in your backyard or in your neighborhood. And we're talking about the '50s or the '60s.
Well, I was born in '53, and so in that time, if it rained, you were essentially, in the swamp. One good rain, and you were pretty much waiting. Waiting out. If there was a road, you were waiting out to it. I mean, it was terribly flat, and probably to some people not very scenic. But to me, it was a wonderful place. You just got on your bike and you rode a very short distance, and you couldn't hear another car. You didn't hear a plane. You were in the middle of what was sort of a jungle. And when you were a kid, that was a great way to grow up. We caught snakes. We were out in camping, fishing all the time, and there was nothing else to do. I remember it was a big deal when the first convenience store opened up near our house. It was like 5 miles away, and it was considered that was a big deal. It was like a 7-Eleven or something. It opened up, and it was like the grand opening of all time. And now, of course, it's unrecognizable. You can celebrate when you find a lot that doesn't have something built on it. But at that time, it was all wild, and that was sort of the context in which some of the books were written. I mean, the contrast between a place that goes from that to being, a big city so fast. You're bound to have, people cracking up and people bursting, the whole place bursting at the seams, which is what it seems like sometimes.
What was your personal reaction to that upheaval? Not your writer reaction, but your reaction as just a guy living in South Florida.
Well, I just love the outdoors, and when you see it disappear, you walk around with a little bit of a sick feeling in your gut all the time. And that's why I always root, you see these stories. I'm always rooting for the alligators over the poodles all the time, I have to say. they were there first, and they're going to be there long after we're gone. But I've always, it's a helpless feeling. There's nothing, you can't change it. It's just sort of the engine of the economy. It's a beautiful place, and lots of people want to live there, and you're not going to stop them from living there. But at the same time, part of me always cheers when a big hurricane rears up and comes in and kicks some butt and sort of reminds us all that we live in a tropical hurricane zone. If we're going to build these nice houses, they better stand up to 150 mile an hour winds, or we're in the wrong neck of the woods.
A lot of people leave their hometowns. In fact, look forward to leaving their hometown so that they can get away from people who have defined them in a certain way, and they could be freer and, you know, reinvent themselves or just have a change of venue. Have you ever tried living outside of Florida?
No, I lived. I went to school for 2 years in Atlanta at Emory University, and it was fine. But I mean, I wasn't really living there. I was just going to school and going home. I haven't had any desire to. I mean, believe me, there are days when I wake up and look at the headlines in the Herald and say, you know, really, this isn't the place I want to be raising a family. But when you're born somewhere and become attached to it and have as much affection for at least the wilderness, the remaining wilderness that we have down there, I feel like I have some sort of moral duty to stay and fight for the place, because I think that if all of us who got disgruntled and discouraged left, then it's sort of a surrender. You know, you write about what you know best. You write about home and a place that you care about. And I certainly, maybe someday we'll set a book somewhere else, but I'm not going to purposely say, now I'm going to go do my book in Rome or Athens now. I mean, that would be kind of foolish for me.
Carl Hyacin, thanks so much for talking with us about your writing.
Well, thank you for having me on the show.
Journalist and novelist Carl Hyacin talking with Terry Gross. His new novel is Basket Case. A new collection of his columns for the Miami Herald is just out. It's called Paradise Screwed. That's Russell Gunn from Ethnomusicology, Volume 2. Coming up, Ed Ward has some psychedelic oddities from England and beyond. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. When Rhino Records expanded Lenny Kaye's groundbreaking compilation of American psychedelic obscurities, Nuggets, to a full 4-CD set, it just brought home how much good stuff there was out there. Now, with Nuggets 2, Rhino has taken on the rest of the world with another mega set. In the first of a 2-part review, Ed Ward takes us to psychedelic England.
Although we tend to forget it thanks to the hegemony of the Beatles and the Stones, in England the 60s were different in a lot of important ways from the way they were in the States. As writer John Savage has pointed out, in England, no one was particularly worried about Vietnam. Instead, youngsters were celebrating freedoms they'd never had before: the end of food rationing, a booming economy, and the luxury of becoming a bohemian layabout if that's what you wanted to do. Because of this, a lot of the bands who appeared there in the mid-60s were either following their own loopy dreams or imitating a band few Americans had yet heard of, The Who. Creation, with songs like Making Time and Biff Bang Pow, were probably the best at this, and like The Who, they pursued a pop art strategy on stage, painting models, destroying stuff, and playing with a full-bore frenzy. Their music, like The Who's, was based in the same R&B the Stones played. Some bands, of course, stuck to the old ways, and in the case of the Pretty Things, who we just heard, there was a direct connection in that their guitarist, Dick Taylor, had actually been a member of the Rolling Stones early on. Others took a middle course, writing less traditional songs, but keeping the nasty sound.
I never saw a night so right for love. Never saw the stars so bright above. Never thought that I could be like this. Just for your sweet kiss. Well, what you gonna say now? What you gonna say now? What you gonna say now? Are you gonna say those magic words?
The Byrds, spelled with an I, not a Y, had been in business for several years when they recorded Say Those Magic Words, and their Stones connection lay in the future when guitarist Ron Wood would join Mick and the boys. In fact, a lot of future stars got their starts in obscure psychedelic bands, like this kid from a London suburb. Torture you with any more of that, but it's Davy Jones in the lower third. Jones, of course, would change his name to Bowie and learn to sing a bit better. Or see if you can find the star in this one. Why, of course, it's Dave Edmunds with his first band, Love Sculpture. But what's really surprising about a lot of this stuff is how well made it was, even if it never made a dent in the world's consciousness. Here, for instance, is a group called Tomorrow.
¶¶
today, people think everything sounded like that in 1967, but in fact, songs like this really stood out. And although this one sold well, it never charted, and the band fell apart. In fact, this whole era, both in the UK and America, is littered with dozens and dozens of fantastic records which few people ever heard. Even so, that's not the biggest surprise Nuggets 2 has up its sleeve. In part two, I'll show you how Uruguay and Czechoslovakia rocked in the 60s.
Ed Ward lives in Berlin. Later this week, we'll hear the second part of Ed's review of Nuggets 2. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our researcher is Jessica Chu. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Charlie Brown works hard all day. Doesn't get home till the sky's gray. Sees his children tucked in bed. He's a man that gets them fed. Sits down by the fireside. The tears fill his eyes. The wind's blowing and the storms are growing. Down to the park till the skies start getting dark.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Dell Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of The Peddler's Grandson, Growing Up Jewish in Mississippi by Edward Cohen, available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the Enron debacle. We talk with journalist Kurt Eichenwald, who's been covering the story for The New York Times. I'm Barbara Bogave. Join us for the next Fresh Air.